STS members and colleagues, one of our greatest challenges as we move forward in cardiothoracic surgery is to address and solve the fundamental dilemma created by two extremely important imperatives, namely the possible clash between our need, indeed our existential necessity, for a continued innovation in the specialty and our simultaneous noble quest for continually improving quality and greater transparency in surgical outcomes. The continued success of our specialty, our life's work, depends on both innovation and quality, two incredibly lofty concepts. But what if these two fundamentally important obligations, which go so far as to almost define us, are at odds with each other? If they are in fact colliding, then this is a challenge that we must sort out. At our divisional, departmental, and health system conferences, we often discuss a number of questions regarding CT surgery. What information is most important to project to our community and our patients? What is the clearest way to communicate our message to our community? In a manner of speaking, how do we articulate who we are? The answer to each of these questions, I argue, are the same. We need to communicate clinical outcomes, and for a lack of a better word, we need to communicate new stuff. Now, clinical outcomes piece can be expressed through the concept of quality, notably the volume-outcome relationship. This is because the fundamental question asked in our office, or offices, is how many have you done? How many have you done? This concept of volume as an expression of both experience and outcomes was explored by a physician couple in a recent JAMA editorial by Anna Reisman. Or alternatively, the clinical outcomes results can be conveyed with more pure quality metrics, such as the STS database outcomes, or as in the state of Pennsylvania, government-mandated outcome reports. And then the new stuff that we communicate is basically communicated as innovation. This part requires us to explain new clinical trials, adoption of new devices, and new operative procedures. But the bottom line is that we, as a health system, articulate the concepts that are most important to CT surgery. It is some expression of both quality and innovation. However, these concepts are often competing with one another, presenting us with a great challenge. When we review our arc of history of the specialty, especially over the recent decades, our specialty has confronted a number of challenges, and some of them have been existential. For example, we had a dramatic decrease in the number of applicants into CT surgery that this profession has ever seen, resulting in the lowest numbers in 2007 and 2008. This was coming off a decade earlier when interest in CT surgery peaked in 1995. Our specialty solved this problem with renewed energy and some soul searching. We created policies and programs, including dropping the American Board of Surgery requirement, as well as creation of multiple, more flexible pathways towards the attainment of cardiothoracic surgical certification, such as the Radical I-6 program, and the retention of the 5-2 and 5-3 programs. This flexibility has proven very successful, as the number of applications are up and quality of the applications is outstanding. What a recovery 9 years later. By my calculation, the present number of applicants to all types of CT surgery programs in 2016 was 230, up from 91, a nadir, in 2007. We can be very proud of our response to this great challenge, which emerged a decade and a half ago. Additionally, as any program director will tell you, starting salaries for graduating CT surgery residents today are very attractive. Indeed, this is good news. The specialty has tackled and is presently tackling other challenges as well. Despite some initial pessimism, TAVR has been adopted by cardiac surgeons and heart teams across the country. This slide shows some of the data from our STS TAVR manpower survey showing reasonable penetrance and a collegial approach in heart team concept, which is in the best interests of patients. Additionally, many TAVR sites in the country are significantly administered by cardiac surgeons or cardiac surgery divisions. The very successful STS manpower survey will be presented on Tuesday morning at this STS annual meeting. Other challenges have been successfully navigated. The thoracic aortic subspecialty, with the help of the STS, continues to meet the challenge of the endovascular revolution. We are continuing to perform more minimally invasive operations and doing it with consistently good outcomes. We have a remaining challenge of incorporating the CTICU as a possible fourth subspecialty area within cardiothoracic surgery. And of course, there are many other issues that our community has successfully addressed. However, I believe one of CT surgery's greatest and most pressing challenges, and indeed a challenge for the entirety of medicine, one of the colliding imperatives of innovation and an unwavering commitment to quality. The concept of colliding imperatives is not new and has been gingerly examined by various thought leaders. More seriously, this concept of colliding imperatives has been addressed by the transplant community in a statement by the American Society of Transplant Surgeons, predicting decreased clinical research as a result of ubiquitous public reporting. So let's focus a bit more deeply into the ideas of both innovation and quality. Innovation within our specialty, and more importantly, forced on us from outside our specialty, will continue. It will not stop. This express train is both incredibly exciting and deeply unsettling for most of the members of our CT surgery community. Innovation and the necessity and required change that emanates from new discovery is challenging for a group of physicians who treat their patients in a highly skilled manner and with an emphasis on excellence and improving outcomes. Our therapeutic operations have incrementally been improving every year, year after year. And the indications for performing them have been tested and evaluated robustly. When a new device or a new approach to treat a disease bursts onto the stage, it is difficult to reconcile our dual reactions. Do I adopt this early, or do I adopt this after more vigorous and maybe rigorous study to the point where it becomes guideline-directed therapy? However, despite possible discomfort, we cannot shirk our responsibility to continually advance our practice with new devices, new approaches, and new indications for treatment as we evolve our specialty and its grand objective to improve the lives of patients with cardiothoracic disease. As we travel down this inevitable road of invention and experimentation, we must assume a certain sophistication in dealing with the ever-present inconsistencies. It will be difficult but very necessary to manage the learning curve associated with new operations. This has been noted by our immediate past president, Mark Allen, in his STS presidential address last year, as well as other presidential addresses, including Drs. Cosgrove, Drs. Del Nido, and Guyton. As these surgeons have declared, innovation has become absolutely critical to the survival of our specialty. We must experiment. We must continually adapt, and I know we are up to the challenge. The concept of new stuff for all of us, whether in an academic center, a large private practice, or one of our regional medical centers around the world, comes in many forms, such as new knowledge or concepts, which are the basis for new operations, new devices, and new indications with existing devices. Additionally, and very importantly, a departmental approach, or even a better, a culture towards new technology is required. A possible example can be found in the modern high-achieving cancer center. This is defined by the Uber vision. Everyone who walks in the door is eligible for a clinical trial. I have modified this concept to the Department of CT Surgery. In this slide you see here, this is the spectrum of adult cardiovascular surgery that we do today. There's an entire a bunch of boxes or a range of programs that we do on a daily basis within our departments. The innovation is to wrap around, or the analogy to the cancer center is to wrap around all of these different areas with clinical trials, just like the modern high-achieving academic cancer center. Clinical trials around ischemic disease, valvular disease, circulation management, thoracic aortic surgery, heart failure surgery, transplantation, arrhythmia surgery, and minimally invasive surgery. And then if a patient comes into our offices and into our hospitals and our departments and cannot enter a trial in this area at this level of tactics, then we have a final common pathway, which is the surgical CT ICU. And they can get into a trial, maybe it's a drug trial, in our surgical CT ICUs. And if they don't get in one there, then we can always follow up with long-term registry trials. Bottom line, everybody can get into a clinical research trial, which is the modern paradigm for a high-level cancer center, but also should be a paradigm of the innovative Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery as well. However, there's an issue with this. What kind of surgical culture can adopt such an approach to innovation within our specialty? How do we attain a culture of innovation? It is critical that leadership is enlightened. Should departmental leadership be mildly autocratic or mostly democratic? Should departmental leadership encourage freedom to faculty and attending surgeons and colleagues, or insist on more constraint? In other words, how should the modern CT surgery department manage the gold-collar worker? Cardiothoracic surgeons are gold-collar workers. Some leaders may be hesitant about pure democracy, heeding Benjamin Franklin's warning that pure democracy is two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for dinner. But in reality, enlightened leadership is necessary in order to achieve a culture of innovation. Enlightened leadership requires at least some deviation from the principles of autocracy. Additionally, as professor and historian Deirdre McCloskey observes in her new book, Bourgeois Dignity, but more importantly, Why Economics Can't Explain the Modern World, she defines freedom, which is freedom of thought and freedom of inquiry, is critical to the development of new ideas. Many societies, and certainly America, tolerates its eccentrics, but some do not. This recent thesis by Isakson explores the benefits of tolerating our eccentrics. In this case, those who created the digital revolution. How a group of hackers, geniuses, and geeks created the digital revolution. Professor McCloskey examines how the West and the rest got rich. The big concept is the great enrichment, and I mean in terms of global economics and purchasing power. How and why did this first sustainable human enrichment start in the Netherlands, in England, and later in North America, and maybe more importantly, not in Mesopotamia in 2000 BC, the Roman Empire at its apex in 100 AD, in Baghdad in 800 AD, or China, which was the most advanced society in the world up until 1700? The answer may be found in the genius of the liberated commoner, or in another word, liberty. This also begs the reciprocal question: is a culture that requires rigid conformity capable of significant innovation by its people? McCloskey makes note that the liberated commoner was an accidental confluence of forces. It had nothing to do with any cultural virtue. It was a mix of conditions which basically paved the way for the common man to have a go at it. Let us apply this principle of the liberated commoner to our cardiothoracic departments. Liberated people, or in our case, liberated surgeons, can be ingenious. So innovation, or importantly, early adoption of innovation, is an imperative. As Andy Grove, CEO and co-founder of Intel, preached, only the paranoid survive. Another way of saying this is, never rest on your laurels, keep innovating. Which takes us to another question. Does the maintenance of a culture of incredibly high quality get in the way of innovation? Tough question, tough answer. And this brings us to the quality part of the potential collision of imperatives. What is quality, and how can it be measured? The STS database has a long evolution towards improving its ability to generate a meaningful set of measures that can discriminate and point to a quality program. This revolutionary journey has incorporated raw outcomes metrics, then risk-adjusted metrics, then continuous updating of the risk adjustment models on a tight time frame, and today it's about every 3 years. This has led to improved communication platforms and dashboards so that both practitioners and the public can understand what our outcomes really are. Don't get me wrong, there are still deficiencies. However, the evolution continues. The actual database itself is improving with time and is refining its ability to discriminate various levels of quality and outcomes. It is incredibly important that the database is robust, as there are some fundamental tensions within our specialty's desire to attain and report outcomes versus a certain unfairness, sometimes noted in the process. And the big questions remain. Are the risk adjustment models strong enough? Do they penalize or reward large tertiary institutions during more complex cases? Regarding the quality metrics, is assigning morbidity equality to certain morbidity measures actually appropriate? And who decides? For example, who and how is it decided that stroke equals sternal wound infection and that they are both equal to the metric of ventilation greater than 24 hours? And then, of course, there's the entire issue of public reporting and whether the data and its acquisition methods are actually sophisticated enough. Can the public appropriately digest and understand the metrics that we present? As Einstein once said, keep everything as simple as possible. But people forget the second phrase, which was, but no simpler. With public reporting, we are smashing into an Einsteinian dilemma. We need simplicity in outcomes reporting. But the reality is that outcomes reporting is indeed very complicated and requires a certain sophistication for accuracy. Is public reporting creating the naked surgeon, as examined by Samer Nasheff from Cambridge? A brilliant author, an outstanding surgeon, and a good friend of mine, Dr. Nasheff is delivering the Lillehei lecture tomorrow, titled The Naked Surgeon, so we can all find out more on this topic tomorrow. We will have to stay extremely vigilant and responsible regarding our measurement and publication of quality metrics. The STS believes that the public has a right to know the quality of surgical outcomes and considers public reporting an ethical responsibility of the specialty. We will have to walk the fine line between the public's increasing insistence on the right to know versus our duty and responsibility towards our cardiothoracic surgical tribe, as we cannot allow good surgeons and good programs to be misrepresented and perish in the public square. Despite Emerson's observation that consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, the most important concept regarding our fine line with public reporting, which in reality is a tangle of inconsistencies, is the dangerous idea of risk aversion. I remember as a resident in CT surgery when first New York and then Pennsylvania 2 years later plastered the public reporting quality metrics regarding CABG mortality all over the major newspapers. One of my mentors and future colleagues, Clark Hargrove, wrote a letter to the editor stating, and I paraphrase, "I can make my outcomes whatever I want if I simply refuse to do high-risk cases." The tragedy of risk aversion in our specialty is that many patients, the value of an operation may be greater in the high-risk situation or high-risk disease state. This is the paradox. This is indeed a tragedy for those patients who are denied care. The unintended consequences of public reporting were highlighted in an editorial from the Royal Society of Medicine in 2015, just last year, by a good friend and esteemed senior surgeon, John Pepper and his colleague Aman Kunar from the Brompton and from Cambridge. The title was High Risk Surgery, The Courage to Fail. They explored the unintended consequences of the NHS policy towards public reporting. They highlighted the truism that those patients at highest risk of mortality or other complications may have the most to gain from an appropriate operation, skillfully performed, and properly resourced. This is part of our dilemma. Additionally, and very interestingly in my opinion, their editorial prompted a courageous letter from the surgical trainees at Oxford, paraphrasing Pepper, entitled High Risk Training, The Courage to Teach. Again, the unintended consequences is that attending surgeons concerned with their statistics may be disincentivized to allow trainees to be primary operators with tragic training consequences for our future. The Shumway reflection, and I quote Shumway, in his 1986 AATS address, and then re-examined by my mentor, Dr. Timothy Gardner, in his 2002 address at the AATS, the only hard thing about cardiac surgery is getting to do cardiac surgery. This is the sentiment that these brave Oxford trainees were warning against. Will this be an unintended, or maybe intended, consequence of the quest for higher quality? I hope not. Our only true solution to risk aversion in a future full of public reporting and ubiquitous outcomes metrics is the notion of nuance. We must be sophisticated in our presentations of these ideas and these concepts. There are basically two ways to properly handle the unwanted calamity of risk aversion. One is to continually develop with increasing data volume risk models that properly adjust for the highest risk category. Currently, this is not perfect, but it is getting better on a daily basis. Another approach is to eliminate or not include in the public reporting paradigm certain categories of high-risk cases, in other words, exceptions. Unfortunately, this latter system has been known to be gamed, and there are many examples of this. To use the title from a recent movie, the bottom line is this stuff is complicated. Quality and innovation. Many people believe that the imperatives of quality and innovation are irreconcilable. The new innovative approaches are inherently higher risk, and that early adopters will suffer from decreased quality. Is there a way out of this dilemma? It may be true that to rescue a collision of these two important forces within our specialty simply requires too much nuance and is not possible. At least from a surgeon's perspective, this outcome would be a shame, and we must resist this sense of inevitability at all costs. As I have said, the solution to our quality innovation dilemma will take a multidimensional mindset and the tools to communicate the logic behind our decisions. There are a number of possibilities. We can use carve-outs or exclusions of certain conditions that are especially difficult to model. Readily available examples of these are the salvage PCI in the NCDR database, or more familiar example to me is the endocarditis valve procedure carve-out in the Pennsylvania State database. Neither of these conditions are included in the Republic report. Additionally, the STS ACC-TVT database for TAVR excludes clinical research patients enrolled in an FDA trial. It remains to be seen whether this type of exception is justified or even actually desirable. And I return to our transplant colleagues at the American Society of Transplant Surgeons in their communication entitled Transplant Center Outcomes Requirements, A Threat to Innovation. And note that this title was not a question. It was a statement by the society. And I paraphrase, the current paradigm of not excluding patients in experimental transplant trials threaten scientific innovation and advancement. They believe that the intent of public reporting was not to stifle the conduct of scientific research. The Transplant Society's solutions are that transplant outcomes under approved experimental protocols should be entered into the database but analyzed separately. This is a sophisticated approach to the innovation quality conundrum that could be used as a possible model going forward. Another possible solution to reconcile our two competing concepts is to explore the relationship, explore the concept of patient-centered outcomes and patient-reported outcomes. In this way, the collision is not necessary if we keep the patient in mind. In this model, we convert the collision into a merger. The patients and their families become deeply involved with the decision-making. We all know, for example, that patients who are diabetic don't really care about their hemoglobin 1AC levels. What they really care about is whether they're going to lose their leg or they're going to go blind. In reality, what they care about is whether they will have a better quality of life as a result of the medical treatments that we offer. By discussing all treatment options with full consent, including high risk and alternative options, we can affect a patient-centered outcome and risk aversion can be moderated. The problem is, unless this can be measured and incorporated into our reporting concepts, the added risk ends up being shouldered by both the patient and the surgeon instead of just solely on the patient's side. Incorporation of patient-reported outcomes, or even more advanced patient-centered outcomes, into our quality metrics will be difficult. It will require a better understanding of this new concept as well as proper execution. However, we must move in a direction that manages the conflict between quality outcomes and continued innovation. Because, as so eloquently articulated by past STS President Doug Wood in our 50th anniversary, our overall professional goal is to deliver the best possible treatments and outcomes for patients with cardiothoracic disease. It is not acceptable to perform a TAVR, a lobectomy, or an open valve procedure and have our patients report that they feel worse 1 year later compared to their preoperative condition. It is unacceptable that they wish they had not consented to a therapeutic intervention despite the fact that they had a physician-defined success by not dying or having a stroke. In other words, a poor 1 year patient-defined result is unacceptable despite the fact that the particular patient had a physician-defined success. Incorporation will require extremely sophisticated thinking, execution, and communication. We need to begin to think about patient-reported outcomes in our long-term quality analysis and metrics. We may need to borrow from Sir Christopher Wren. When he was thinking about both nuance and execution, he reiterated a famous Latin epitaph, circumspice. In other words, take a hard look around you, connect the dots, and wrap your brain around the concept. So I implore you all to incorporate the twin imperatives of innovation and continued quality improvement into your practices. I ask you to search for solutions for yourselves and your programs so that these two important imperatives don't collide. This requires out-of-the-box thinking. But remember, we make the boxes. We construct those boxes that constrain our thinking. Physiology and pathology do not. Our cardiothoracic surgical forefathers bequeathed to us a great profession. I sometimes think of Benjamin Franklin and the signing of the U.S. Constitution. A citizen asked, "Mr. Franklin, did you give us a democracy?" "No," he said, "we gave you a republic, if you can keep it." And the surgeons who came before us left us a proud and distinguished profession. We need to continue our stewardship. It is ours if we can keep it. We must continue to improve our specialty every day. My colleagues, it has been my highest professional honor to have served as your president. I remain deeply, deeply humbled. Thank you.